This is going to be real informal, but I've titled this whole series of what will eventually be four sessions, Horns and Halos. And what I'm trying to do is to help us understand why at times our behavior is very positive and self-affirming, and we're, you know, little angels, we're just wonderful, nobody can find fault with us. And other times we can get pretty, word I use is gritchy. My daughter gave me that one, combination of gripey and bitchy, and that's kind of a good word. We can get there. And there are many reasons why there is this divergence of behavior. And what I'd like to do today is to go into an understanding. What time are we supposed to start?
About
10:45, that's what I thought, yeah. The bell is just ringing. Is to help you understand the tremendous crisis that we're finding ourselves in, and what for better or for worse is called a total shift in paradigms. The basic foundations upon which our whole world and our understanding of the world is built is undergoing such a fundamental change that it's a miracle to me that we aren't all deeply psychotic. I mean,
I think we all are.
We all are. Well, let's say we're a little bit neurotic and stay away from totally being psychotic. I think there's a basic difference between being neurotic and psychotic. I don't think the world has ever seen a change in fundamental perspectives as the one that we've experienced the last 40 or 50 years. One might say that the movement that began with the invention of the printing press that ensued then in the Renaissance was such a tremendous shift in paradigms, and that may be true, but people had more time than we're having today. We just are not permitted the luxury of time in the age of instant communication. So what I'd like to discuss today is, what are some of these paradigmatic shifts that are occurring that we're right in the middle of? And there are several, of course, and you might add some others to the ones that I have. One shift that, you know, we don't think much about, and yet sort of ignoring uncertainty. This is the fact that we're reaching the end of the fossil fuel age. The energy that you and I grew up with, that we took for granted, cheap fuel, unlimited supply, is coming to an end. And we have seen two crisis situations when the Arabs decided to cut off the taps, totally unnecessary from a supply point of view, but totally necessary for their political and economic needs. It made this nation apprehensive, because we stood in gas lines and signs were out, you know, don't top your gas tank, and we wondered where the next tank of gas is coming from, and so we had a little foretaste that somewhere down in the future, we don't know when it'll be, the source of energy that we relied upon is simply coming to an end, and we are also, on a subconscious level at least, realizing that those who are in position of authority are not doing anything about it at all. We're not coming up with any alternative plans. I mean, meaningful, substantive, long-range plans to develop alternative sources of energy. And I think we realize that throughout history, he who has energy controls the world. Back in the Roman days, energy was what? Manpower. You had the slaves to control the world. That's how Rome controlled the world. It enslaved everybody. England made fantastic use of the steam engine. England controlled the world. America was the prime producer of natural oil and refined products we get from that. And America was a world power. And we realize now that that play is coming to an end, and it upsets us. Not something you realize, you know, consciously every morning when you get up.
When you say it's coming to an end, what do you mean coming to an end?
Well,
in the next 100 years?
I'd say within 75 years, whether it'll be 50 years, or if we keep on a conservative growth with our consumption of raw crude oil, you know, the figures are uncertain. I don't think anybody would see much more than 75 years.
I have been in the oil business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I doubt.
Yeah, I know.
If Exxon, if Standard Oil,
right.
If they're going to allow it to come to an end.
Well,
okay, they're the biggest companies in the world. I mean, Exxon is the largest company mm-hmm. in the world. Their whole product is fuel.
True. Right.
Not necessarily gasoline, but yeah. Crude oil.
Yeah, okay? Right.
And they're not going to let their companies dry up. They're going to think of systems to keep the system rolling.
Well, I was an oil and gas business too, and I share your appreciation of the tremendous impact of the major oil corporations. And if the major oil corporations would think of themselves as being in the energy business, I wouldn't be afraid. But right now, that's not evidenced. Right now, they're still in the oil and gas business. And as long as they're oil and gas business, there will come a time when it's a renewable resource, and it's not, it's a non-renewable resource, I mean. And unfortunately, the fellow who's drilling the into the Silgen Ring in Sweden, he's, you know, had the idea, what's his name, Gold, I think, that oil is not organic in origin, but comes from the interior of the earth and undergoes a process in coming filtering through the various geological formations. If he's right, then we'd have an unlimited supply, but so far the Silgen Ring has been negative, the drilling that's been done in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I share your concern. I wish Exxon and Texaco and all these would be in the energy business. Then we could go into geothermal, we could go into solar, we could go into all sorts of things, but there's no energy. There's no energy program in the United States today, is there?
Well, those companies, I think those companies will. They'll drift into tar sands, and they'll create some synthetic oils from coal. But okay. The major difference is going, you know, to kind of fill somewhat the same type of a market.
Right.
But the cost of those things is going to be much, much higher. And it's going to, the haves are going to be able to have it to a greater degree. And we're not in a cheap fossil fuel.
Right. Right.
Will disappear much more quickly than fossil fuel.
All I'm concerned right now is that we're realizing we're in the midst of a big change.
Yes.
In our source of energy, and that bothers to some extent. It's a subconscious thing, but still it bothers us, I think. A much more fundamental paradigmatic change has occurred is the end of the patriarchal age. When I grew up in the old country, but my mother walked 2 paces behind my father. We went for a walk on Sunday afternoon. Dad walked ahead, and mother knew her place. And all of a sudden, the day and age, my wife wants to tell me what to do. It's just, we're a different age. I mean, women are coming into their own, and this is upsetting the apple cart. This is a very big shift. All of a sudden, these second-rate citizens are saying they're just as good as we are.
Let me pick up on a comment. You said your mom knew her place.
Yeah.
Who defined place?
Well, I think in that culture, the male, the man, the husband defined the place.
But I think...
Under divine authority.
Yes. Now, if you... back a little bit away from the Judaic, Grecian, and Roman, and then argue about it. There are other cultures where the role of a woman is very defined and separate from the role of men.
Right.
And there's a respect for what the women do. Mm-hmm. I think what you're experiencing now, along with the rest of us, is particularly in the Western world, as the service industry begins to become a larger part of the economic base. Women have the ability to think and to use the facility tools equally as men. And that's where some of the paradigm shift is taking place. And if you're in the right place, so to speak, you feel threatened. Mm-hmm. If you're in the marketplace where you're looking for talent, you're looking for a whole new potential source of thinking, working people.
Sure. I think you've described the situation very well, and it's a change of a fundamental dimension, as far as I'm concerned. And you see all these men's movement all of a sudden. We put in Indian feathers on our head and beat the tom-toms, trying to be men again and trying to find ourselves. It's been unheard of 30 years ago because we knew who we were and we knew who they were. They were second-rate citizens whom God created out of our ribs to serve us. It's just that simple, eh, you know? And that's changed, and this causes uncertainty and insecurity and some of the tension. But I think by far the biggest tension that is being created is in what I like to call the change from the modern to the postmodern world. Do we have any physicists in this group? Anybody here? Because I'm certainly not a physicist, and I've just dabbled in this thing for the past 10 or 12 years, and I've studied myself, and it's been a very slow process. But we grew up, my generation grew up, if you will, up until, one might say, until the 1920s, somewhere along in there. The world was based on Newtonian and Cartesian philosophy and mathematics and physics. And it was relatively simple. God created a perfect world. Now they made a very strange statement after that. If some parts of this world wore out or were a little bit, grew somehow tired or weary or something happened to them, we just replaced them and perfection was restored. That's sort of a, just think about that statement that people like Newton made. And Newton made this statement that the world is created perfect and when a part wears out, all we have to do is just to replace it. Now, what is so totally ridiculous about that statement? How can anything that's created perfect ever wear out? Perfection means that it's perfect, and anything that's perfect doesn't change, it doesn't wear out, it's reached the stage of equilibrium that cannot by force be changed. And yet for, you know, centuries we went along and say, yeah, God created the perfect world, and if something wears out, we just replace it. Never asking ourselves, what does it mean that a part may wear out? Now, Newton believed in absolute values. In Principia, he wrote, there is such a thing as absolute time and absolute space. And a funny thing has happened to human beings, obviously. It's a predisposition of the human mind. And I call this the Ptolemy's folly. You know what Ptolemy was? I didn't either until a little while back. Ptolemy was a 2nd century astronomer who was an extremely, apparently, brilliant man whose system of categorizing the stars and sizing the stars is still basically being used today. So if somebody, you know, did something 1700 years ago or ever long that astronomers with their modern knowledge still rely on today, I mean, that guy was a brilliant guy. But Ptolemy had a accepted Aristotelian and Platonic assumptions about the nature of God. Plato, Aristotle, all of these great philosophers who have so infiltrated the Christian faith have said that a perfect God created a perfect world. And a perfect God reveals himself in perfect geometric figures. Ergo, all planetary paths are perfectly circular. That was an a priori assumption of the ancient world. And Ptolemy bought into that. Ptolemy was a very brilliant observer of the heavens. And he looked at planetary orbits and realized that those planets are far from being circular. But he believed so strongly that a perfect God revealed himself in perfect geometric figures that he came up with the concept of epicycles. And epicycles are simply little perfect circles that follow the larger perfect circle. And as the planet goes around these little perfect circles that are attached to the larger perfect circle, it gives the appearance of being an elliptical path. And so Ptolemy said that there is still a perfect God and his perfection is just revealed with these epicycles. In other words, what Ptolemy did was to defend a false assumption with a false explanation. And human beings are prone to do that. And would even lend further scientific support to this assuming false premises with false assumption is then what people have done from day one, but which received scientific strength and support by Newton with his statement that they're absolute values. So you have human beings saying, I'm absolutely right in saying that God is absolutely perfect by making perfect circles of the orbits of the planets and defending these absolutist statements with false assumptions. And I said this is the main disease that human beings have been beset with since creation until the beginning of the postmodern era. Now, before we go into helping you understand, you know, what the postmodern era really is sort of all about from a quantum physics point of view, I've got three little quotations here that have meant an awful lot to me.
You want to pass these around, guys? Nothing that passed me.
William James said, "The greatest revolution in our generation is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives." Any comments on that?
As a man thinketh, so is he.
Yeah. Excuse me. Okay. Now, the second one is by Alan Watts, and that has been extremely helpful in my journey. Belief, he says, as I use the word here, is the insistence that the truth is what one would leave it or wish it to be. The believer will open his mind to the truth in a condition that it fits in with his preconceived ideas and wishes. That's Tommy. Faith, on the other hand, is the unreserved opening of the mind to the truth, whatever it turns out to be. Faith has no preconception, it's a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings, faith lets go. In this sense of the word, faith is the essential virtue of science, and likewise of any religion that is not self-deceptive. Now, if one believes in absolutes, that's a hard pill to swallow. Because if I'm absolutely right and you disagree with me, then you're what? Absolutely wrong. And if we pursue this long enough, what would be the result of our absolute positions?
You're going to come to blows sooner or later.
You're going to come to blows sooner or later. You know, I believe what I believe what I believe. You do the same thing. And so one of the reasons for the mess that the world is in, I think, is because modern science espoused Newtonian absolutism. And so we really had no conceptual, philosophical, even religious way out, because religion, not in the ideal religion of the New Testament, but how in the application of that ideal religion, became very absolutist in its nature in most churches, sects, and denominations. So by believing in absolutism, we did not give ourselves an opening to resolving our conflicts.
Also, I think, if I may...
Sure, please.
In the demise of the Roman Empire, going through the Middle Ages, etc., even into late 17th century, there was a very distinct and clear linkage between the state, the religion, and in some ways the culture that the two supported. Now, when all those things are sort of in a happy cohesion, things are fine. If you're coming up, like our friend in Galileo, you're the odd man out. We had Inquisitions, we had the Crusades, because people, I think what we're getting into now, and this is, I think, where you're leading us, is that we are now getting to the point where diversity, where it is defined and acknowledged, there is a richness in that, although there's a discomfort in that if you're locked into a position.
Right.
But we're getting to the point where the marketplace is third world, it's the rest of the world. Cultures are very different than our own, we need to understand that.
Yes.
But let me stop there.
No, that's great, that's fantastic, yeah. It's being forced upon us, whether we like it or not, but I think that an understanding of some of the basics of quantum physics would give us an intellectual appreciation as to the changes that are happening right now. Let me just, before we go into that, into Herbert Spencer's quotation, and I love this because it's a beautiful English to my mind. "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is a proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation." So when you mention Galileo, I mean, this is what we have. We had a contempt prior to investigation. If you ever have a chance to see Bertolt Brecht's play entitled Galileo, go see it. It's a perfect example of this. It's a wonderful play. Now, what is it that happened when quantum physicists began to look at the world? Now, there's been an age-long old question which preceded the postmodern era. And this is scientists try to figure out what actually is light, which after all was one of the components of the Big Bang or of creation, you know, whichever way you want to go. If you want to believe in a Big Bang, well, we know that As soon as the bang occurred, along with the subatomic particles, there was light. If you want to go with scripture, you know, then God separated the light from the darkness. And so scientists have tried to figure out what in the world is light. Now, you know, most people can live and labor and love until they die and never have an answer to the question, but the scientific mind isn't satisfied with that. Newton insisted, because of his faith in absolutism, that light is a wave. He had no tolerance at all for any proposition that said that light could be particles. Well, the experimentation of quantum physics, which began around a little bit after 1900, revealed a rather interesting thing. That light, lo and behold, is both a particle and a wave. What this means is that this is not an either-or universe, but a both-and universe. This is not a John Wayne universe in which he comes riding into town and gets rid of the bad guy. And he is right and the bad guy is wrong. It's a both-and universe, and which absolutism takes on a very peculiar nature. And the nature of absolutism in this modern world, postmodern world, is that it includes polarities. The old absolutism would say that only this position is right. To the extent that one can find an absolutism in the postmodern world, it says that the whole embraces opposites. The whole embraces the light as well as the darkness. It embraces the particles as well as the waves. It embraces the good as well as the bad. And there's an interesting theological perspective here. A perspective that the old, ancient Old Testament writers understood extremely well, which the New Testament writers, particularly St. Paul, completely misunderstood. I was really shocked when I did research on this. I did not bring the passage with me. I should have done that. I think I'd get off on this aspect of theology. But the Old Testament writers said that God is the creator of both good and bad. God unleashes the bad, and it is not the devil. It is simply the nature of God to contain polarities. I bring evil upon the city. I think this is in the other Jeremiah or Isaiah. God assumes, well, the best is the story of Job, is where you find it in a narrative type form, where God calls an assembly of the angels. And one of the angels happened to be Satan. And Satan, God's angel, says, I want you to test this man Job, whom you have so much pride in. And God says to this Satan, he says, well, I'll give you authority to do anything you want to do to him, just don't kill him. But Satan is an angel of God. Now, this has tremendous theological implications that I don't know if we're ever willing to face these implications about the nature of God. But the quantum world forces upon us to realize that the world that you and I live in is not one of opposites that stand divided from each other, but of opposites that are part of an undivided whole of an implicate nature. I think to make that change, because I was reared, there is good and there is evil. And most of the things that my society stood for were good. All the things my church stood for are good and right and divine and all that good kind of stuff. And if you were different from the way I was, you were wrong. You were evil. You were bad. White is good, black is bad. Huh? Even symbolically in the language. And all of a sudden I begin to realize, because if I believe that God created this world, he created it on those conditions that are now being shared with us by quantum physics. This is how the world is put together. It began with this creation, this big bang. And we know, you know, that nothing, no energy is either created or destroyed. And all we are simply the result of an evolutionary procession of the elements that you know, evolved into stardust, and you and I are basically stardust. And we include everything from creation. Both and. And all of a sudden I have to realize that, it's very hard for me to say this, but, and this may be, I hope you'll forgive me if I say this, that I even have to accept President Reagan, Mr. Dole, and people of that type. They're part of the whole schmear. And I have to accept whatever other people I intensely disagree with. And I have to look and see how this is all part of one whole. That makes any sense to you? And that's shocking. I mean, that's new in the world. This is new in the world. It's very New Testament, this part of it. You know, how shocking was it when the woman was taken in adultery and the law said, Moses' law, any woman taken in adultery must be stoned to death. And they picked up the stones and Jesus said, hey boys, any of you don't have anything in any skeleton in your closets, if you don't find any, go ahead and throw the first stone. New Testament combining law and grace in some way which really to our minds is still very difficult to comprehend. And yet quantum physics reinforces this unconditional love of the New Testament by saying that there is a polarity. It is not an either or kind of a world, it's a both and kind of a world. That's the first thing that quantum physics teaches us, taught me. The second thing is that classical physics says they're independent states. In other words, states, physical states exist independently of each other. A condition in physics exists. Light exists independent of darkness. That'd be one way of putting it. Planetary motion exists independent of any other laws of physics. The individual states that exist. What quantum physics found out is rather fascinating. They found out that in an experiment that set up his equipment to prove that light is a wave, light behaved as a wave. If you set up the experiment to prove that light is a quantum, a particle, then light behaved as a particle. That Latin word is quanta. That's where the word quantum physics comes from. That light is now to be understood from the point of view of being particles rather than waves, and this makes some very fundamental difference in how we understand light. So while classical physics says a perfect God created a perfect universe independent of any outside agencies, quantum physics says that the assumptions of the observer determine the outcome of the experiment. How you enter into the process determines the results that you see. Now, when we take this idea and broaden it out into a more relational, theological kind of a perspective, all of a sudden you see what I must say is not that Moses, and it's not that Moses said that God said, and then we say this word is the absolute word of God, but rather that Moses says that God says. And there's an interesting thing which is quite shocking, was totally shocking to me, and it can be quite shocking to most people of our generation because we simply weren't reared that way, is to understand that in the Old Testament we see that God is not absolute. The best illustration of that is this really beautiful story of God and Abraham. When God looks down and he sees Sodom and Gomorrah all caught up in their sinfulness and all caught up in knowing all their vices, and God says, I'm going to go Abraham and I'm going to tell my chosen one, you know, what I'm going to do. What I'm going to do, I'm going to destroy these two cities because they're so wicked and evil. And Abraham listens to God and he says, hey, Lord, what if somehow I go into the cities and I find 50 righteous people? Will you destroy it for 50 people? And God says, well, no. If you find 50, I'll not destroy them. What does this say to us? God can be influenced, huh? And then Abraham says, well, now, Lord, because he began to have some doubts of the 50 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah. Say, Lord, how about 40? You know, can we make cut a deal on 40? And God says, yeah, I mean, oh, I'll buy into that. And Abraham then began to have some more doubts and more doubts, got it down to 10. Now, will an absolute divinity bargain with man? I think not. But we have other examples where God is influenced by human action. Now, if we take a quantum principle, and I know theologically these are very revolutionary things to be saying. I fully understand that, and I appreciate, you know, any criticism you might make of me and any names you might call me, perfectly all right. I don't mind it at all. Not that I have a thick skin. I'm a real nice guy, but I've gotten used to this sort of thing. We must come to the realization that human beings have a tremendous input, and the assumptions that we make will determine the outcome of events that God has not predetermined. What's going to happen to us? I think right now God doesn't have the foggiest notion what's going to happen to this planet. If we persist, if our assumption is that we will make profits at all costs and the heck with the environment, and we'll go down into Mexico, and we will continue to build factories. You're familiar with some of those problems in San Diego, not as much as we are in Texas, in the valley. And we allow these poisonous chemicals to be spewed into the atmosphere and to be pumped into the rivers. And we see an unbelievable, they're statistically unbelievable, number of children being born without brains. Have you heard of that in Texas and the Rio Grande Valley? We had in a period of 1 year, 5 children in one area born with just the brain stem, no cortex of any, I mean, neocortex of any sort, just brain stem, maybe a little limbic system, a little basic ganglia, but no cerebral cortex. If we pursue that, you see, then we're making assumptions and the world will go one way. On the other hand, if we say, we're going to put a stop to all this, we're going to curb our materialism. We're going to curb our appetite for money. We're going to curb our appetite for more and more and more and more. Then the consequences will be different. The position of the observer determines the outcome of the experiment. Man is put into a position where instead of being a mere, quote-unquote, servant of God in the sense that he is a real servant, being put in a position to be a co-laborer with God to shape and determine the destiny of the cosmos. That's revolutionary. That puts responsibility upon us that, you know, I don't think we ever realized we had before. If God is perfect, create a perfect universe, and I can go out and dump stuff into the river and it's all predetermined anyway. And this quantum physics doesn't allow us to do that anymore. This is a quantum shift in understanding. The third thing that quantum physics teaches us is what is called Heisenberg principle of uncertainty. And all of these things were discovered back in the early 1900s, the early, so they are 70, 80, 90 years old now. Heisenberg found out, with a real interesting experiment, that when one looks at a subatomic particle, one can determine the direction in which this particle is movement, but for some reason, I'll be very honest with you, I don't understand the mathematical equations, one cannot determine the speed. Or, one can determine the speed of the particle, but one can't determine the direction in which it is going. Now, I'm sorry, I don't have the mathematical proof, I don't understand it, but please take my word for it. If you want to read it, read the best book I've seen in this area, is Bohm's book, Undivided Wholeness. He is a theoretical scientist at some British university in London, Birkbeck University in London, highly respected authority, and his book is fascinating to me because he has, you know, the most complicated mathematical stuff in there that I certainly understand, but he intersperses it with just common, ordinary sense. And when one goes through the book and picks out, you know, what one can understand, the conclusions that he reaches as a result of the experiments, and, you know, no one disputes this thing with Bohm. And in a sense, it's the same thing that Hawking says in his much more popular book, A Short History, Brief History of Time, Short History of Time. But at any rate, there is an uncertainty in the very genesis of creation. There is something that is left, if you will, open-ended. And so if there's something that's left open-ended, we're doing away again with absolutism, with a predetermined kind of a universe, and we're making human beings far more responsible for the kind of a world in which we find ourselves. Any questions or comments? The last thing that I want to mention, which, and you see, what's so fascinating about this thing is that all of these things dovetail within each other. And the most significant conclusion of quantum physics, which Bohm comes up with, is this one phrase that I've used several times, that we've got to realize that the universe is an undivided whole of an implicate order. It's an undivided whole of an intertwined, interlaced, interrelated kind of an order. Nothing that takes place here does not affect something's place here. And in a previous study session we had that I attended, they talked about Isaiah, and they didn't look at this passage, but I happened to read above the passage that he used. And I'm glad I found this passage. And it is amazing how much of the stuff that quantum physics tells us is contained conceptually within parts of the scripture. Isaiah 24:2, and it shall be, and see, this is what we don't understand in our society, because here we have, and I worked in the corporate world for about a total of 12 years after I was in the ministry, and I left it and went in the corporate world, and so I think I know something about corporate structure, and here you have management over against labor. We've got union labor against non-union labor. And we are suppliers fighting each other, trying to get to something. Everybody is over against everybody else. We've got politicians making decisions because this group, pays a lot into my PAC. Now, no politician would ever admit that, but then we got to grow up and be realistic. And therefore, if our PAC, I ask our president, I says, he wanted us to put $5,000 into somebody who wasn't on our side of the fence. And he said, well, John, the reason you do that is so that you have the chance to talk to him. If you don't put $5,000 in his campaign chest, you call him up, you ain't going to get an interview with him. So we put $5,000 in somebody's campaign chest who was opposed to the oil and gas industry. But I made the call myself when I said that we want to see you, that our president wants to see you. Got an appointment within less than 10 minutes. That's how it works, doesn't it? This against that. And if legislation is being passed that favors me, then it's going to go against you. It's either or. This is what the prophet says. And it shall be, as with the people, so with the priest. Now, the priests and the people back in those days really were dichotomized. The priests were a notch above the people, you see. And here is the prophet saying, as with the people, so with the priests. That's heresy, isn't it? As with the slave, so with the master. As with the maid, so with the mistress. As with the buyer, you're apparently in marketing, so with the seller. Isn't that interesting? As with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the creditor, so with the debtor. Isn't the SNL scandal a perfect illustration that this is an intertwined order of an implicate whole? It's an amazing thing how this man, 2,700 years ago, could have this kind of an insight into an implicate order of an undivided whole, which is the big lesson that quantum physics teaches us. Any questions? Comments. I want to do one more thing.
What is it that Isaiah is saying, as with? Because he could be talking about as the rain falls, on the priest as well.
Well, no, the first verse, I didn't read that because I'm the first verse. Behold, the Lord will lay waste to the earth and make it desolate, and he will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. So that whether you're a priest, or whether you're a master, whether you're a mistress, whether you're a buyer, you're going to have the same fate as the people who are below you. And the people below you will suffer the same fate as you suffer. It's all one schmear. You're all intertwined. I may take another minute. I don't know. What time? I've got 10 more minutes, haven't I? At least about 5 more minutes, yeah. Another thing, which is completely away from quantum physics, that I learned, and Kurzweil, who was not a classical traditional scientist, but he had this uncanny ability to take scientific principles and distill them down, relatively understand them. And more than that, he had an unbelievably imaginative mind. And the one thing that I appreciate about him that he helped me to understand is to describe the basic organizational principle of the universe. How did God, or does God, because I think he's still doing it, these are the other sessions I'm going to do, but anyway, I get to that. How has God decided he's going to organize this shmear? You know, if you want to use simplistic imagery, God was in his study and he was looking at all the textbooks that were available to him, and he said, I think I'll make me a world. I think I'll make me a cosmos. But how in the world am I going to organize this shmear? Well, you know, I'm going to put it together. It's got to be put together one way or another. And Holon calls this organizational principle of the universe by the word holon. H-O-L-O-N. And he says the holon has two aspects to it. The holon has self-assertive qualities, and it has integrative qualities. Okay, he begins with subatomic particles. We can describe a meson or a quark or any of these other subatomic particles we know about. We can say what they are, we know how they behave, we know they have speed and have direction, and they do certain things, and so they can be said in a sense to be self-assertive. One can identify and one can say this is a quark or this is a meson or whatever it happens to be. But the quark and the meson then become integrative. They combine together and they form the nucleus of atomic particles. They merge, they have positives and negatives, and they form the building blocks of the universe. So while you can say this is a quark, you say, but the quark also is this. He talks about this in a book called Janus, J-A-N-U-S, which of course is the Roman god with two faces looking into two directions at the same time, the past and the future. And that's where he got the idea of the self-integrativeness. Now you look at atoms. And certainly we can talk about atoms. Hydrogen, we've got an atomic weight to it, and we can make it in a sense. We can, you know, get it through chemical processes. We can isolate it, and there's a lot of things you can say about hydrogen. But hydrogen then has the integrative quality of uniting with other atoms, if you will, and forming molecules. And you can talk about molecules individually, all the way up to the cosmos. Probably the best illustration might be the human body. We have 10, 12, I don't know what it is, systems, a nervous system, and cardiac system, and a circulatory system, digestive system, skeletal system, nervous system, all kinds of systems. And there are a lot of things we can say about the digestive system. And the doctor books are full of the digestive system, okay? You get my age, you get some problems with the digestive system. And it's very self-assertive, believe me, it is. But until there's the integration of these 10, 12, 14 systems, until that happens, we don't have a human being. So that there is this principle, you see, of self-assertiveness, individuality, identity, but integration at the same time. Now, the interesting thing, of course, about human beings is, and most other elements, constituent parts of the world, in a blind process, subatomic particles will unite to form atoms. Atoms will unite to form molecules. Molecules will combine to form more complex systems. And all the way up and down the scale, this is what you find until you come to what? Essence. Essence. We have these tendencies, right? They're all self-assertive. They all integrative. But in human beings, the balance is lacking, isn't it? When we become too self-assertive, what do we become? Well, we become dictator. Or something like that. And I'm not just talking about Hitler. There are a lot of dictators in the individual family units, aren't they? A lot of fathers, a lot of mothers are dictators. If a person becomes overly integrative, then he becomes neurotic and psychotic, contemplates his own evil. So human beings have this unique challenge to balance the self-assertiveness with the integrativeness in order to further, if that's what you want to call it, the cosmic destiny for human beings. And I think Jesus, says, he who would be greatest among you, let him be what? Let him be your servant. He would be greatest among you, let him be your servant. So he would be greatest among you, self-assertive leader, let him be your servant. And until we learn some of these things, you see, the human being is sort of outside of the will, if you want to use this word, the divine purpose, the divine will, the divine plan. And so my hope is, that somehow, as we go through this paradigm shift, we begin to realize that the new laws and the new ideas that have been laid down in the prophets, if you read the prophets from that point of view, again, the subjectivity enters into this thing, that maybe we can find a foundation which will bring us to a little better world. Certainly, I think quantum physics would indicate. But it's a painful process. And this is part of the horns and hails effect, that if we go against these things that I've tried to share with you, it'll be horns. If we go there, it'll be halos. Okay. Questions?
Comments? Now, relative to humans, we've gone through a series of interactions where it's win-lose, lose-win, lose-lose. I think we begin to find that win-win pays benefits all the way around.
Absolutely.
Win-win requires a certain degree of self-confidence, a certain degree of knowing who you are and knowing your interrelatedness with other folks.
Yes.
And yes. I think on the higher scheme, as far as the good Lord is concerned, quite often it's been win-lose because we have not been cooperating. To the extent that we cooperate, and here's where both chemistry and physics, right, I personally am aware of, gives us insights into the order in which, the order in the environment in which we live. Obviously, as a human, we've got the ability to some degree, run counter to that, to our own detriment. Right. But a win-win environment works out all the way around.
Okay, I appreciate that because it allows me to provide a commercial at this point. The next sessions we'll deal with how to develop a win-win attitude. What can we do with ourselves and our behavior, and what can we learn? And I think there's some things that that you might not have thought about before that are rather interesting to deal more with the intrapersonal factors. And how can we develop a little bit more halo and a little bit less horns? You've been a great group. I've enjoyed it. We'll see y'all. No. Thank you. We'll see y'all.
Can we have these?
Yeah, you keep those, right?